to our session about blogging. I'm really excited that you're all here, and I'm really excited to be here. it's 2013, and it's interesting what's happened in less than 10 years with blogging. My name is Jude Isabella. I'm a freelance science journalist from Victoria, BC, and I'm on the board of the CSWA, and I'm also the CSWA's blogger boss, so some of you might know me just by email if you blog for us, if you contribute to our main page. And again, you're in the right session if you're here about blogging. Some of the questions we're going to ask is, this many years after everybody started blogging, is it worth it? Is there a blogging community in Canada? Can you belong to a blogging community in Canada? And if you do, and if you blog, some of you have a question about whether you can pay the rent. What I've done a bit of reading about kind of the history of it, and the conclusion I've come to is whether a science communicator or a science journalist, blogging can be an important tool for a writer. Now, first, I want to talk a little bit about the beginnings of blogging. Most of you know it because you've followed it as science writers. You probably read blogs if you don't blog yourself. But it has changed dramatically over the past 10 to 15 years. And I defer to Bora on this. And if you know science bloggers, you know that some of them are rock stars, and we just call them by their first names, Bora, Ed, Carl, and Jennifer. And I'm pretty sure you all know who I'm talking about. So let's go to blogging in the 1990s. From what I can tell, and again, this is a lot from reading Bora's history of it, the only people doing it were really people who were very comfortable around a computer. They were often scientists who wanted to communicate science, or people who just really liked to mess around with computers and write. The software evolved, which meant a lot of us could get on board, blog, and I think that's when it really went explosive. There was a huge debate for many years. Actually, not many years, considering how far blogging's come in such a short time. But there was a debate that I think is fairly dead now between old-school journalism and blogging and the legitimacy of blogging. Blogging has evolved into a legitimate form of journalism, with many of the big-name bloggers parked at old, established brands, Scientific American, Nature, and National Geographic. Now, when Ed Yong began in 2006, blogging was marginal to the business of news. And I remember when Ed first started blogging, because I contacted him, I sent him an email, and I said, you know, I knew he was a communications person for a cancer society, and yet he was moving into this freelance kind of gig. And I asked him, how do you do that? Because it's kind of frowned upon here in North America. And he said, no, in the UK, we can do it as long as we don't write about what it is we're the communications person for. So that was kind of interesting. Now, to quote Ed, who blogs for National Geographic's Phenomena, what's happened is that one of the most prestigious nature science magazines in the world gives us money to write what we feel like with no editorial control without ever having to pitch to them. Does that sound like a dream gig? How did it change from being a side thing to a dream gig? That, to me, epitomizes the transition of the field and form over the last 6 or 7 years. That's really quick. A short time, but it's changed a lot. Blogging has changed. But has the blog changed? Personally, I don't really think so. I think it's always been something each individual adapts to their professional ecosystem. Bora, writing about the history of blogging for Scientific American, gives a definition. A blog is a place to think in public. Blogs are not supposed to be, with the occasional exceptions, polished, self-contained pieces. I'm not sure I totally agree with that, having read some very polished, self-contained blogs. But to get back to Ed, I think he gives the best advice. If you don't find it fun, don't do it. If you're forcing yourself to do something you don't like, it won't work. So I'd like to introduce our panel, Lisa Willens. Lisa has been working in science communications since 2000 and is currently the director of communications with the Stem Cell Network, one of Canada's networks of centers of excellence. She has a strong interest in online communications and launched Signals blog in 2009, where she serves as editor-in-chief and occasional contributor. Next is Colin Schultz, a freelance science writer, editor, and videographer based in Guelph, Ontario. He covers the science behind the news for Smithsonian Magazine's newest blog, Smart News, and writes about everything from earthquakes to solar flares for the American Geophysical Union. And then there's Pascal Lapointe, Pascal has been a journalist for 25 years, specializing in science and new technologies. He's worked for Agence France-Presse since 1996, where he is editor, publisher, teacher, and administrator. He helped launch the website of the agency and added blogs in 2005. I think I'll stand up. You guys probably see me better this way, yeah? Okay. All right, you'll have to pardon me for having notes on hand, and we'll just pull this up here. And I'm going to start, as she pulls that up, with a little bit of information that you didn't hear in my introduction or my bio, which is sometimes I break rules. Although I try to break unwritten ones, usually. And I'll just advance the slide. How does that relate to science blogging? Well, when I created Signals Blog in 2009, I kind of broke rules. I mean, what I mean by that is I kind of wrote new rules. And the reason for that is because when I set this blog up, now you have to understand where I come from. So I work with a network of centers of excellence, and I'm hoping most of you kind of know what an NCE is. Yeah, if not, you can look it up. But it's one of the granting agencies, or uses the granting money in Canada. We are government, but not government. I am with the Stem Cell Network, one of the NCEs, and we get about $6.5 million per year to fund research, do training initiatives, and some public outreach. Anyway, when I started working on creating this blog in 2008, there was nothing else existing within the NCE family of about 40-odd networks. Nor could I find anything like it within SHRC, NSERC, CIHR, which are really kind of our counterparts. So I was creating something that really didn't have a precedent, at least in Canada. And so I just kind of set out to say, well, what is it what I wanted to do? I wanted to kill a paper-based newsletter, a magazine that we had at the network that I had no metrics for, just realizing how much it was being read. And I wanted to switch to something which I felt was becoming more and more prevalent as a tool for communicating, which was online communications. And so I switched it to a blog. In saying that there wasn't anything else there, there's now actually one other network that runs a blog. And I'm not trying to discredit them by saying they should all have blogs, because I don't think they should all have blogs. I don't think everybody has the resources to create a blog. I don't think that it works for every kind of center, but it works for me, and it works in part because stem cells is something that I think have a lot of resonant interest in the public, and also because I happen to have a really good boss who says you can do whatever you want. So that works. Okay, so we're a bit of an outlier. I consider us to be a niche blog. We're not a corporate blog, even though we've got nice corporate logos up there. We are not a corporate blog. We're not an individual blog. We're kind of an aggregator, which I'll talk about in a minute, but we are definitely niche. We are a very focused area of research, which is stem cells, and that's all we really blog about. Okay, next slide. Okay, sorry. Yes, good. We're good there. Okay, I'll try and not belabor too much the boring parts of the communications part, because I know you guys probably want to hear more about the writing and what we do, but a little bit more of history, just to kind of tell you what I wanted to do. So I had three goals in starting this blog. The first was to kind of expand our brand internationally. The second was to be able to provide a forum for discussions and communicating information about stem cell research. And then thirdly, I had a goal to mentor young researchers in public outreach and science communications. But I want to get back to that first point. So I said I wasn't a corporate blogging yet here. I just talked about expanding our brand. So I'm very, very careful about this. For me, this is a very important thing. Our logo is up there, but our blog pieces don't talk about the Stem Cell Network and how great we are. A blog to me is not a mouthpiece for a corporation. A blog should be about community building, and unless that community is within your own corporation, I don't believe that kind of corporate speak should be there. I save that for my media releases and my newsletters. So this, for an example, is a research story that was actually created by our scientific director. But if you read this piece, I sent this to one of our bloggers to write about. She didn't know anything really about him or his research specifically. And there's nothing in there about who he belongs to. It's more about the story. It becomes more of like a science communications piece than it is about the network. Okay, next slide. Okay, so who works for me? So as I said, I'm the editor. I also contribute occasionally. I don't contribute as much as I would like to, but I do. I've had about 18 bloggers work for me over the past 4 years. Currently, I have 13 that are non-staff, so you'll see I've grayed out the ones that are staff. Of the 13 I have working for me, 11 are research students. Two of them are actually PIs working in labs. Four are outside Canada. Six of the ones on this list have actually gone on to establish some other writing. They're not career writers like you guys are, but they are researchers who have kind of branched outside of academia and are now working in part as science writers. They've contributed to other science publications. So in that sense, for me, this has been a really successful enterprise, because one thing I think is really important about blogs is how much they cross boundaries, and it's allowed these researchers to get more involved in science communications. So I pay my bloggers. I know there is a you can probably find lots of blogging opportunities where you can do it for next to nothing, or $25 a post, or I don't even know what the going rate is. I don't pay what a professional science writer would expect to be paid. I don't know what the going rate is per word, or whether you guys still get paid per word, but I pay 40 cents a word to my bloggers, in part because I think it's important. Is that good? Is that bad?
40?
Maybe 40.
What is that, the word? A word?
Yes. Is that terrible?
Well, like 50 cents for 100? Like usually?
Is that what it is? I don't know. So that's what...
$40.
Wait,
40 cents. 100 words is $40.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's not great. No, it's not great. But for blogging, I think it's actually not bad, because a lot of bloggers get paid next to nothing or nothing at all. And the other thing is that, like I said, this is kind of like a mentorship, and it's a training piece as well. So this is because most of these guys are working for me are students working in labs. Having like $250 here and there as extra pocket change isn't really a bad thing. So I had to get that out there, because you guys probably ask what I pay. But yes, I do pay. If you think it's horrible, come and talk to me later. If you guys think it's great and you want to ask me about work, come and talk to me later. okay, I think... All right, next slide. All right, I'll get on to what we were told we were going to... When we talked about this advance, we said we'd talk about the five things we had learned. Well, I started out with five, but I ended up with six. So next slide. So the first thing I've learned is that blogs are nimble and inherently without boundaries. And I think Jude talked a little bit about that in her intro. Blogs have changed tremendously over the 10 years of their history. And blogs, I think, have changed how we read, write, and think about science. And an example that I can use for that, now this is a research blog, and are you guys all familiar with the Arsenic Life story? You guys know Arsenic Life, Rosie Redfield? It's okay. If you don't know it, Google it, and I'll give you a little bit of a background. But Rosie Redfield is a scientist working out at UBC who had come across this paper, and I can't remember who it was published by, but it was published in Science, I believe. And the premise of the paper said that arsenic, they had found in some lake in Utah somewhere, that arsenic could sustain life. She looked at this paper. This was going to be a great big paper. NASA had talked about putting out some media circus about, you know, how if arsenic can support life, then we can have, you know, extraterrestrials and this sort of thing. So she read this, and she said this. She looked at the details of the paper, and she said, this is not right. And so she posted on her blog, which at the time had, like, next to no followers, this little post. She put it on a Saturday of all days, and by Monday she was inundated with calls because she refuted Arsenic Life, which was this big science paper. Anyway, so I bring that up as an example of how blogs can change things, because they challenge. They have the ability to challenge in real time what's happening out there. And another example of that are things like blogs called like Retraction Watch and PeerJ, which keep track of things that are happening in journals. So if a mistake is made and it gets retracted, well, usually it was kind of lost in the small print, but now there's actually blogs out there that'll track it, and if it's a big enough deal, then people will make much of it, and things will actually get called out in the real world rather than just in the fine print. So I think they connect. They connect research and researchers with the, and making them more accessible to the public. They connect across disciplines and across geographical borders. And then because they're also so inherently, they're online, you can use images, you can use videos, so they have way far more reach in terms of how you can engage with an audience. Okay, next slide. I'll try and be quick. Okay, number two, the second thing I learned, blogs need personality. They think they need passion, they need life, they need vivid language, and all these things are things that all science, good science writing has. But I think the important thing about blogs is it can be hard to get an audience in a blog, right? So unless you're writing for the Smithsonian or Discovery or Scientific American, or if you want to start your own blog, it's hard to get eyeballs, right? So you need to make sure it's got personality. And I'm not saying that you have to spill all your personal details out in your blog, because in science writing, it might not be a good thing to do that. But I think you need to relate to your audiences, and there's opportunities to relate in audiences in different ways. So for example, you, and the nice thing is because it's not tied to print, and print has, you know, an inherent cost, right? So that's why articles and print are short, because it costs money to put it there. But you can be longer in a blog, and you can bring in your personality. So for example, if you love the Game of Thrones, okay? Everybody loves Game of Thrones. You could actually take that and say, well, let's see, I think that the adolescent eating abilities of, or the eating habits of adolescent dragons has actually got something important to say about how human adolescents eat. So you could bring those two things together in a blog and bring your audience that way. That's the kind of thing what I mean by personality. Okay, next slide. Blog about what you know and what interests you. I think this is pretty obvious. And I think that ties into the personality, because if you're interested, if you're knowledgeable about something, that comes across in the blog. So, you know, it's obvious if somebody's not interested in what they're writing about. I think that comes across. And so, you know, find, and if you don't, you know, you don't have to be a researcher to be doing this, right? Like I said, I work with researchers all the time, but everybody's got knowledge, right? And everybody's got an interest, and those are the things you can, if you want to become a specialist in the blog area, that this is one thing that you can follow in order to gain that audience, gain that traction. Because not everybody is Ed Yong. Okay, let's go next. All right, you can have an opinion, but you need to be able to support it. And I think this is essentially very important in science blogging. There's a lot of blogs out there that are strictly opinion. They're not necessarily science blogs, because science is also about data, and it's about facts, and it's about proof, and it's about logic, and it's about being able to tie things together. So if you have an opinion, even if it's different from somebody else, say, again, with Rosie Redfield, who said, I disagree. She went out and said, I disagree because I think this methodology was wrong, this methodology is wrong. And then she set out to actually prove it by trying to replicate the experiment, and she was right. Okay. Second, last here. So this one, engage, engage, engage. This one, I have to say, for me, has been the hardest one for me to learn, because I tend to be a very kind of private person who doesn't like to draw a lot of attention to myself. And so when I started running the blog, I didn't put a lot of effort into getting out and engaging, trying to get people to read it. I figured, you know, put it out there and they will come, and that really didn't happen. And so then I had to put more effort into kind of engaging and bringing people to the blog and promoting it. And it started to work. And I'll just show you an example on the next slide. Okay, so this is from my Google Analytics. Love Google Analytics. Here is the last year of readership on my blog. And don't pay attention to that one. We posted something really interesting about the US election and embryonic stem cells, and everybody loved it. So it's a bit of an outlier, but you can see there's this point. This is in January. In January I said, I'm like, okay, the blog's been slowly growing, it's been doing okay, I'm getting the readership I want, but can I do better? And so I put a lot of effort into increasing the amount of Twittering that I do, and connecting with other bloggers. And you can see, I mean, it's obvious, I think. You can see a trend. So we're not hitting the zero lows or almost zero lows that we had before. And overall, we're doing better. And I think this is the only thing I changed, was increasing my social media presence and just getting out there a lot more. So I'm going to continue to do that. And last slide, last point, sometimes you need to break rules, and that's the last thing I learned, and that's it.
I'm going to sit. If I stood, I don't think the camera would be able to fit me in the same frame as the screen. So thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Jude, for putting this together. My name is Colin Schultz. Oh, I'm going to wait. I've got it in front of me here, so I'm in my own little world. I don't know, you're so organized. I think it's called, what's it called? Blogging presentation.
Blogging slides, PDF?
Yeah, there I am.
Jude, and let us see your taxes after.
Just go back one. Yeah, so, actually, no, that's fine. Sorry. So I'm Colin Schultz. I'm a science journalist by training. That's what I did for school. I'm also a blogger. And so unlike a lot of people who blog, that Lisa was talking about, there are many different types of bloggers. And unlike a lot of people who blog because it's their hobby or they want to do, they're scientists doing outreach or they have a passion about something that they just need to tell the world about. For me, blogging is my job. I do sometimes write blog posts. I have my own blog, other than the work blog that I write for. Not nearly as often, it's probably a few times a month. So, in preparing for this session, the next slide, please. One thing that Jude asked me to talk about was money, because I do make a living as a blogger. It is my profession. So, how do you make a living as a blogger? I think that's a very fair question, and I think a lot of people are probably wondering about that. So this is the private blog that I have, my WordPress site, the free WordPress that I put together. I get $0 from this. If you were going to set up a WordPress blog and put Google Ads on it and expect to make a living at that, it's probably not going to work. There are very, very, very few people in the world who I know of who are self-sustaining just from their individual blogging efforts. It's not a very clear path. So that's not what I'm doing, and that's not where the money that I make comes from. So next slide, please. I blog for Smithsonian Magazine, and so it is very much a job. I don't write what I want, when I want, whenever I want, however I want. I do write however I want, mostly. But I have an editor. I have deadlines. There's a team of us. There's three writers and an editor doing this. I work part-time. I do 12 stories each week. Together, we do 36 stories a week, Monday to Friday. I'm seeing it's a pretty quick turnaround. It's a part-time job. It's somewhere between 15, 20 hours a week. I get about 40% of my income from this part-time job. I do other things to round that out. And unless you want to hire me, you don't get exact numbers on what I make. So next slide, please. So like I was saying, the blogging that I do for Smithsonian is a little bit different than what you would do at home. This is the people who invented Blogger. I want to call it journalistic blogging. So I have a background in journalism. That is sort of the profession that I've entered, and I happen to do that through blogging. So that's sort of what I want to talk about for the next few minutes here is, what does it mean to be a journalist who blogs? So it might be a bit exclusionary to people who aren't journalists, but this is sort of where I'm coming from. So what I want to talk about is journalistic blogging. What do I do? What do I mean by that? How does it work? How do I do 12 stories a week in 15 hours? So next slide, please. So the number one thing that I think is probably true for every journalist is that trust is the most important thing that you have. People need to trust you. And for them to trust you, you have to be accurate. So my career runs on trust. If I want to advance, people need to trust me. They need to know that I'm someone who they can trust for to get their information, which means I have to deserve their trust. Next, please. The other thing that I have to do is I have to be interesting. I have to do original stories. I have to do things that people want to read. It has to be accurate. But just being accurate is not enough if you want people to come and look at your work. You have to be original. You have to be interesting. Next, please. And that runs into the number one thing that I think you can probably recognize is the amount of time that I'm working within. There are very tight time constraints. I have about an hour for each of the stories that I write each week, or each day. I can take a little bit longer if I want. I can take a little bit less if I'm not working on something quite so big. But in general, I have about an hour to research and write each story. So at this point, I think a lot of the journalists are probably freaking out. And I need to point something out that this sort of blogging is incredibly high risk, in that if the most important thing to you is trust, if the most important thing that you have is that you're right and accurate and that people can trust you as a source of information, how do you do that in an hour, right? So it can be very high risk. Every time that you publish a story, you're putting your name on the line. And I work for Smithsonian Magazine. The Smithsonian is a cultural institution. They've been around for 167 years. The magazine's been around for 40. I don't want to tarnish their name either by doing something inaccurate. So I really don't want to be the guy who screws up the Smithsonian. I just don't want to go there. So how do you balance those three factors, the accuracy, the originality, and the time constraints? And so that's what I'm going to be talking about. I don't have all the answers. I don't think anyone does. I don't think all my stories hit this mark. I try to at least get the accurate one, right? But I'm going to try to use some examples from my own work to show we've been doing this. This part of the Smithsonian website has existed for a year. And so what have I learned in this past year that works, that does, I think, hit those three things? So next slide, please. So the first thing that you have to realize about blogging is you have to play to your strengths. It's a very common thing for anything that you're doing. You have to play to your strengths. So I'm not out in the field. I'm not out there with a camera interviewing people. I'm not chasing down leads. I'm not doing shoe leather reporting. That kind of thing you can't do in an hour. So you're not going to be breaking news, right? So you're a journalist who will never break news. So it's sort of a strange thing. There's also the reality of working in an hour where you can't really do interviews. You know, you could email someone to fact check something, you can send a tweet to someone to make sure you're right, but you're not doing intensive interviews and looking for juicy quotes. It's not something that you have time for. Because the most responsive person in the world is not fast enough. And even if they are, you'll spend an hour talking to them and then you're out of time. But I think that's sort of okay. And here's why. Because there are a lot of people doing that sort of journalism. We could use more. I'm sure we all want jobs. But there are a lot of people doing it already. What I think there are less of is people who take a step back and say, what do you need to know outside of what's happening right now to understand what's happening right now? So one of the first types of stories that I've learned to write in the past year is how to put the breaking news into context, how to tell the history of this event. So I do have a bit of a benefit here working for Smithsonian where they love history. So that really, it plays into me a fair bit. So the next slide is an example of this sort of story. So I think a lot of you probably remember when this happened. Clint Eastwood gave a very, very, very strange presentation at the Republic National Convention last summer. And, you know, everyone was writing stories about this. What did people in the room think? What did people at home think? Did the Romney campaign have any idea that this was going to happen? Right? Like, what was he doing? Was he going crazy? Like, lots of stories analyzing every different angle of this. What I think a lot of people didn't realize, and I didn't realize until I kind of sat down with my editors, like, okay, so this happened. What do we do? There's a long history in American politics of people debating empty chairs. It's a really weird thing. It happens all the time. And so the story that I wrote was the history of Americans debating empty chairs. It goes back to at least 1924. I found a source it's called Saffer's Political Dictionary, about when this technique arose. And then also, you know, more modern occurrences and like people debating empty chairs in other countries, and like someone debated an empty chair last week who wasn't you can tell this story. So rather than just saying, look at this crazy thing that happened, you can start to understand it, right? You can put it in context, historical context, and also this is not a unique event, right? This happens. So some Googling really was all that it took to put this together, but people really liked it. It gave them something to understand about the news. I got picked up by the Washington Post. There's a Wikipedia page about this. It's got my thing as a citation. So I think that's nice for me. That's just kind of bragging. So there's another example on the next slide of this same sort of thing, right? The meatball, the IKEA, like the horse meat in meat in Europe, in lasagna, in whatever. And so the story had been around for a while. We kind of ignored it because I didn't really have anything to say. But it came back when they found it in IKEA meatballs. I forget which country it was in. So it was sort of like it was becoming a global issue at this point, sort of a regional thing. So it gave the story new legs. But it had been, you know, it had been around for a month or so. It had been covered to death. How can you say something new about something that's been covered from every angle? But you know that horse meat is going to be something that's got history, right? So that was what I did. I started looking around. I was looking for, actually, old recipes on how to cook horse meat. I thought that would be interesting. I couldn't find any, but what I found instead was this old story from 1875 from Scientific American, where they were laying out point by point the economic incentive for why Americans should adopt eating horse meat as like a thing. So, you know, it's the same thing. There's this story, it's around. Here's some context, here's some history. So that one got picked up all over the place. I got to go on NPR and talk about it. It was their fun kicker story. But again, okay, so these are all, those were both sort of examples of weird, quirky history, which is not, if you're setting out to do breaking news and you're like a really hardcore journalist, maybe that's not what you're after. I do have an example on the next slide of a way that I think you can do something really valuable while still hitting these, you know, you have an hour, you have to be right, and you wanna contribute something valuable. So this story came out about 2 hours after the first Oklahoma tornado, the EF5 tornado that went through Moore, after it left the ground. So it, like, it touched down, and 3 hours later, this was there. It probably could have been faster, but I was at a coffee shop, not paying attention. I was watching on Twitter what was happening rather than thinking about writing. So this story, you know, during breaking news, you get a lot of information. And so here people were talking about the path width of the tornado. You know, was it a mile wide? Was it 2 miles wide? The wind speed, was it this wind speed or this wind speed? Which category of tornado was it? And none of that really means anything unless you know a lot about tornadoes. And I like tornadoes. I think they're interesting, but I don't, that's not an immediately understandable thing. So again, you can put it in context. So I went through and I wrote this story about, we know a lot about tornadoes. We know about their history. We know about the biggest one and the widest one and the one that killed the most people. Where does this fit? And so it's not about topping it. It's like, is this the new number one tornado? But it's more about, you know, what? How can you understand this strategy that's still unfolding, right? That people were still trapped in schools, right? But how can you understand this tornado and the history of the world? So that's the first kind of story that I've learned that can really work in these constraints, is the history and the context. So the next kind of story that I've learned about is, relies on something that I'm going to call outsourcing your trust, and that's not pure weasel words. What I mean by this is, in an hour, I cannot verify everything that goes into a story. It's not possible. So what that means is you have to rely on other people and their work to provide facts for things that you then use. And this is where I'm promising it's not weasel words. So the way that I'd like to describe this is, when a story goes wrong, when your story is wrong, it is your fault. It is not whoever's story you quoted's fault. So you have to, here's what I have. I need to know who I can trust enough to put their name around my neck, right? I'm going to hang myself from the Guardian story, and hopefully it holds. So you put together this list of people who you trust, whether it be mainstream media, bloggers, researchers, people on Twitter that you follow and you know that you trust them. So you have this list of people that you trust, but you want to put together a story that's accurate, that's original, and in a short amount of time. So the easiest way that people get around this, and this is, I think, where blogging from sort of an old school media perspective gets a lot of hate, is that you can reblog. That's what it's called. You take someone else's story, you take their work, you take all their effort, and you just spin into a new package. You don't want to do that. It's sort of, you know, the idea of rewriting a Wire story. People used to do that all the time. They still do. You don't want to do that because it makes you feel bad. And those stories don't do very well anyway because they'd rather go to the original source. People, you know, they'll find the original source. But I think that there is a way to use other people's facts and rely on their research and their reporting to tell stories in new ways, either through reframing the story or through synthesizing and putting things together that, you know, were from all different people's efforts. So I have an example of this on the next slide. I'm a gamer as a hobby, so I pay attention to the gaming press. And there was this new game that was that had come out. It was a guillotine simulator. It was this new virtual reality goggle thing that tracks your motion, and it's got 3D and the whole thing. And so the people built this, and it was like a hackathon. They put it together in a weekend, this guillotine simulator. So the gaming press was like, look at this neat thing. This is really cool. And the story you could have done, the easy, lazy story, is here's this neat thing. Look at how cool it is. But I remembered reading a story by Ed Yong a few years ago in Nature where he delved into the research of virtual reality and how through these techniques that researchers are pioneering, you can actually cause very realistic reactions to virtual reality. You can make yourself feel like you're in another body. You can make yourself feel like a giant. When you see a dummy get stabbed, you feel it. So putting that information together with this guillotine simulator game, I think became a much more interesting story about what the people watching themselves be beheaded would have been feeling at this time. So on the next slide, it's sort of the same idea. NASA had put out this new picture. It was really pretty. People were telling stories about, look at how pretty this picture is, which is a lot of places do stories like that. But you can round it out by relying on other people's reporting and other people's work and synthesizing it and putting it together in new ways. So here it was, the story was the picture. You want to see this picture. But to round that out, you pull in information about Arctic sea ice decline, and you can tell a new story that this beautiful picture of the snow-capped Arctic might be the last picture like this that we get because the sea ice is declining so rapidly. And it seems sort of weaselly, you know, the reblogging idea, but usually if you're just pulling little bits and pieces, you're pulling facts from all different places, you're sourcing heavily, you know, you say, says the New York Times, you give them full credit for doing the work, people are usually okay with this kind of thing. They don't, you know, they don't think that you're riding on their backs too much. So those are both examples of stories where I was relying on mainstream media sources, Nature, I think this one was Nature too, I like Nature. But it also works with bloggers and researchers and people on Twitter and these sorts of things. So in the next slide, I have a story that I wrote recently, and it was sparked by a blog post that someone wrote for a New Zealand geophysics research company called GeoNet. And they'd observed this earthquake that had been happening since January. It was a magnitude 7 earthquake, and it's this strange thing called a slow slip earthquake. It's actually been in earthquake conditions since January. It's just really slow. So I know a fair bit about slow slip earthquakes. And so relying and trusting this blog post, because it comes from an organization that I've learned to trust over time, I was willing to put my name on the line to write this story using their observations of this event and rounding it out with other work. So that's sort of the second way of telling stories in an hour that I think people find interesting and that are accurate. Is that you can reframe things and put things together in new ways to tell new stories using already verified facts because you know that the other person had done the due diligence, so you can sort of rely on them a little bit. So in the next slide, I mentioned earlier that working online in a coffee shop on your laptop, you're not going to be breaking a lot of news, and that's very true. But in science news, what you can do is you can find new things because a lot of science reporting is sort of paper-based and everybody's covering Nature, everyone's covering science, but there are a lot of journals and there's a lot of interesting studies and there's a lot of interesting stories to be found within those studies. And so you can rely on your expertise in that area of research. So everyone, you know, you develop specialties whether you want to or not. There's just things you know more about than others. And if you trust in that expertise, you can find stories that other people can't find. So for me, my area of expertise is earth science and climate change things. For the other job that I do, that's all I write about. So over years, I've read a lot of papers. I'm getting semi-confident that I can find a study, read it, understand it, and write a story about it, and get it right. So that's the third way that I found to write stories, is to rely on the things and to trust your own knowledge and to trust your own expertise and to trust yourself to tell stories that are true, that are interesting, that you can find on your own. The trick and the catch with this is that standardly on a paper-based story, you'll have that cranky scientist at the bottom that says, you know, you have to be careful and we need more research and more needs to be known. They're not there because you can't do interviews. So you have to do that. Right, you have to put in that little bit of legwork to find things that might be wrong. You can't stray from the paper too much. You can't say, and this will cure cancer, because that's never going to be in the study. You have to stick to what's what's there. If you trust the study, you stick to what's there, and you don't overreach too much, and you find some caveats here on your own, either through previous reporting by someone else on the same topic or just things that have happened in the field. So that's the third way, is to trust your own expertise. So I have a couple quick examples of this that I'll blow through because I'm eating way too much time. So I said that what I know the most about is earth science and climate change. So I found this report from the BC Oil and Gas Commission showing that hydraulic fracturing, fracking, causes or can cause earthquakes. People know that, people tend to think that this happens, but generally what it is the wastewater injection after the fact causes the earthquakes. This was an instance where the fracturing process itself actually caused earthquakes. And there are not a lot of examples of that out there, but I trusted what I know about this topic from learning about it and reading about it a lot to dig through this report and find and quote from and rely on that study to tell a story that people were interested in. So this whole idea of trusting yourself is very scary for me because you want to be right. And I kind of put off freelancing for a few years because I was terrified I'd get something wrong. But I think it's worked out pretty well so far. So the same idea is you can use what you know to add on to a story, right? So this was the original story was, I think it was the government of Saskatchewan had shut down a research group who was working on guidelines for carbon capture and storage. And what I already knew about carbon capture and storage and what's called negative emissions technologies, pulling carbon dioxide out of the air, incredibly important. And if we don't have something like that, we're locked into about 1,000 years worth of climate change. It's all in there. There's quotes and studies. But so I already knew that stuff. So you can find this news peg and add on what you already know and tell a new story that is accurate and quick. You can do in an hour. So I do this kind of story less often. And then I've got one more with a cue picture of that kind of thing. You find a study that other people are not necessarily reporting on, but you find it because you've learned to sort of understand what the jargon in those studies means, and you can just do it yourself. So that's all I've got. I ate 6 extra minutes. But yeah. So I'm Colin. We're going to be doing questions after, but I'm online, and I'm always on Twitter, so if you want to talk, that's probably the best way to get me. So thank you.
So hello. So despite my huge accent, as you can hear, allow me to try to do this in English. For those of you who speak French, pour ceux d'entre vous qui parlent français, c'est facile de trouver mes textes un peu partout sur les blogs, but I think that people here speaking English are less familiar than what I have to say about science blogging. So I'm a science journalist since 25 years, working since a while for the Agence Science Presse, which is a small media here in Montreal, a not-for-profit media, a unique case in the French-speaking world, a scientific press agency. And no, we are not doing any profit with that. We are born in 1978, so this year is our 35th anniversary. You can imagine that we are very active on the internet. In fact, we are there since 1996. The program was giving a date, which was 2005, but that this is the moment when we've created the blogs, the first science blogs in 2005. More on that later. Maybe I should wait a little bit.
this is yours, isn't it?
Maybe it's a
No, c'est là, on a, voilà. Oh, that's good. So, this is me, this is the Agence Science Presse. So, next slide. I assume most of you knows about this conference. I was there in January of 2008, this conference in North Carolina called, at that time, Science Blogging. And for those who are skeptical, it was, yes, a real science convention with classical academic panels and a workshop and some less classicals. But in 2008, I was back there, next slide, it was renamed Science Online. And in the intervals, what was interesting for me, it really became a community, since community is one of our common goals this afternoon. In 2012, the old debate, are you a journalist or a blogger, was not at all in the agenda anymore. 4 years before, it was still possible to sense on some arrogant attitude on some bloggers who were saying, you journalists are disappearing, but hopefully we bloggers will take your place. In 2012, what we were seeing was rather the contrary. Journalists and bloggers rather worried about the future of journalism. And also from scientists, advices like to their colleagues, please stop criticizing media and journalists if you don't know what their work is, and rather try to understand why they do work differently than scientists. And one way to learn for scientists is blogging. So, why a community? Next slide. Why a community is so important in the context of science blogging? Well, in part because of this last sentence, the importance of knowing each other, learning from people who are already doing the job, if you are a scientist, and listen, don't just communicate. We all know, of course, the information ecosystem is changing, there are a lot of new players, which is good, and journalists have surely learned one thing or two in the last 3 centuries that could be useful to these new players. And also, especially to these new players, as a teacher, I encounter them frequently, those new players that always do the same mistake. I know my subject, therefore I can communicate to a larger audience. What Science Online is showing us is what a community means in the internet era. You know this concept of a conversation, two or three clicks. If you are not familiar on science blogging, if you are not familiar at all with blogging, in fact, this is what we mean when we are all talking about a virtual conversation. And a virtual conversation is the basis of a community. So as Colin was saying, or maybe it was Jude, you have to look at what's happening on other blogs. You have to subscribe to some Twitter feeds. You have to engage. This was Jude, I remember the captain. And one indication or counter-indication of that is when we are seeing some clashes with people from the outside of the community, people who are writing about blogs and reveals their misconceptions. The last one I saw was from a group of researchers last winter who published a research saying that on average scientists do read blogs less than they do read newspaper, no surprise there. But there was an interpretation about why it is this way. And it would be because science blogs are a no zone for quality. Blogs are supposedly written quickly, without proper editing, and without the kind of complexity and nuance that we see in journalism. I can assure you that this does not correspond in any way to the science blog that I'm reading since more than a decade now. And I hope that Colin does not consider that it does not make any nuance. How do we say nuance in English? So what about this thing about context? If you are skeptical, or if you know people who are skeptical about blogs, you will surely know people who do things that blogs are superficial and without any context. Think of it this way. Some of the most popular bloggers, the three next pictures, one of them has been quoted either by June and by Colin. Ed Young in the center, Carl Zimmer on the left, and Andrew Lefkin on the right. These are some of the most popular science bloggers in the world, in the English world. They are three science journalists. They write for a living, as Colin do. Their credibility is in their writings. So can you honestly think they would suddenly write on the fly because it is a blog? And they do science writing because they love it. We can ask the same question. Can you honestly think that if you give them more space and more time than an hour, they will not use it to explain things, to put things into context? Last week, Ed Young wrote this blog about the origins of the birds in light of, again, another fossil. And look at the length. I think it's six screen pages. And with reference on the back. Try to imagine something like that in your nearest newspaper. You will never in a subject like that. You will never find a thing like that. There are about only blogs who could have published something that long, that not specialized. It's easily unsortable for everybody, but it would be impossible to imagine in La Presse here in Montreal. In a way, in Quebec, we already have an embryo of such a community. Agence Science Presse, as I was saying, created Science en Blog in 2005. It was the first group of science bloggers in French in the entire world. We are a little bit proud of that. And our goal since the beginning was always to try to create some conversation between bloggers, bloggers, mostly scientists at the beginning. It was a long shot. It has been during some periods done with zero revenue, so it was alive and dead depending on the years. We are light years from the English-speaking community. We are light years from the American or the British bloggers. In their world, there are thousands of science bloggers now, and some of them are writing since 10, 12 years. Some of them are writing every day, and some of them are even unpaid. I don't know how they do it. But we don't have any individual remotely like that in French. But since last fall, we accomplished something which I think is very important. When we discovered we had the critical mass to create, next slide, to create this, a book. It has just been published less than 2 months ago. It's the first anthology of science bloggers in French. There has been some inspiration in English since a lot of years now. But in French, Les meilleurs blogs de science en français, édition 2013. 80 blog posts written by 48 bloggers from Quebec, from France, and a few other countries. So one of the questions of this panel was, is blogging worth it? Well, if your post is in this book, it is still worth reading 6 months or a year later. You want context, you want explanation, you'll find it in this kind of post. The English, I hope you all know the English equivalent, Best Science Writing Online, and an annual yearly anthology. So I said that at the beginning, the debate between journalists and bloggers does not make sense anymore. But I know as a journalist that any journalist wants to know if there are differences. Take, for example, a columnist in a newspaper. He or she can also be a journalist. But there are differences between the way they work. So is opinion the answer? The problem is you have bloggers giving their opinion continually and others who are much, much more discreet. Rosie Redfield, if you find the examples that Jones was giving, was not writing an opinion piece. It was a long analysis. In fact, you know what I mean. We've tried. There are three other items that go on and up where we are trying to define what are the differences. And they all have problems. We are not the only one. We've tried before the books and many people before us to find what could be the huge difference between blogger and journalist. And for each of those items, we could debate all day about what it could be, where we draw the line between bloggers and journalists. The independence factor of course, is very important for us journalists. For example, a scientist working at McGill University and blogging about McGill University would be a problem from a journalistic point of view. But what if he's blogging about anything except McGill University? I do think, as a journalist, that the independence factor will still be vital in the years to come, but I also think that if anybody wants to understand where the news, the new ecosystem is going, we will have to accept the fact that, for better and for worse, the old definition of journalism has to be updated. So, what's new? If, oh yes, imagine this kind of thing. Let's try the one, yes, what's new? What's new and where can you fit in there if you're not already blogging? Well, thinking about that, I realized that there was one small bit of information that could be news for a lot of you. Could be useful for beginners amongst you. During years on the web, if you were looking at the menu of science magazines, you were always seeing the same categories: astronomy, life science, technology. Today, take a look at the blog networks and you will see some strange categories like science and policy or culture or science communication or simply a lot of blogs about how do science works. We all know that if it's your blog, you can write on every subject you wish. But why are those themes popular enough to emerge as new categories? And I should add that in our book in French, when came the time to regroup the text in chapters, we find the same thing, the same tendencies emerging. So here we have maybe an indication that a slightly different information is emerging, subjects that we would not have been able to find in science magazines because not popular enough, like open access, next slide. Subject like that have a place now. Next one. Subject like open access. You would find an article like that 10 years ago in Scientific American once a year, once every 2 years. Now you can have blogs explicitly devoted to that. And also we find more and more subjects that remind us how much science writers are more critical about science than they appear to be. You know, outside of our circles, we are frequently accused of being spokesperson of the science. And of course, being critical needs more space and more time than just reporting this morning's discovery. But those writers critical, they are all there. Those writers asking questions, they are all there in the blogosphere. And I hope they will find their readers. Because it's my last question. Next slide. Examples of people critical. Who is going to pay? Because all this leaves us, we all know it, with this dark cloud above our heads. Who will pay? The evolution is tricky for people willing to make a living about science writing. And I'm not talking about teachers in university who are blogging on the weekends or on the slide, but people who will need some paid contracts to pay their rents. I don't know if you know it, but people like Colin are still in minority, people who are regularly paid to blogs. Majority of science bloggers are unpaid people. And as you all know, science journalism is not in good shape, and it's not becoming better. Of course, we can say that there are more science writers out there than ever, and it's a good thing, but it's not good news if a small minority of people, if maybe less and less people, are able to make a living about it. Who will do the long-term research? Who will follow a beat during years? In Quebec, maybe we are in a more precarious situation. We know a lot more about this because we have only a 7 million people market in French. So there is almost no freelance journalist in Quebec who can survive on a science journalist basis only in press, in written press. They will work on other subjects than science, they will do work for television, or they will work in communication. In the rest of Canada, you have a similar problem with the fact that you don't seem to have a market for a Canadian science magazine, a Canadian-born science magazine. governments can help in subsidizing science culture as they do it in Quebec. But I think that the institutions in science and research will have a serious questioning to do. Next slide. Yes. As this editorial in Nature was saying, since 20 years there have been institutions have been very efficient in creating communication offices, public relations offices that gave to writers a lot of marvelous opportunities to communicate in science communication. But if you feel that is not enough, if you feel that next to that some independent press, some independent writing and Canadian-born writing would be important, universities and funding agencies will have to support it sooner or later, because private companies are not interested to buy ads next to science news. Newspapers, I don't think they will invest more in science journalists if they don't have a pressure to do it. And the readers willing to pay for science news or science blogs, I'm sorry to say, but they're not so in so huge number. So to conclude, you could say, why would an institution support blogging rather than real journalism? Well, because of the hybridation question. The two of them will be more and more one. And already more and more people are doing one and the other without the feeling that they are doing two distinct works. So I think if there are opportunities to, next slide, last slide, see if there are opportunities to science blogging, to create some kind of network of Canadian science bloggers, we should look at university and funding agencies. Here. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. We have time, about 25 minutes, I think, for questions. So I will raise your hands, and I will come over with the microphone, and we'll start with Stephen.
So it's a question for Colin. You're not going to tell us how much you charge, but can you tell us how many hours a week you work?
Working for a Smithsonian, I tend to do probably 20 hours a week.
In total, how much do you work?
Oh, how much do I work in total? For those two jobs, I do about 44 hours a week. I have two regular contract jobs, and that's pretty much all I do. I don't do a lot of freelancing on the side.
Do you, outside of that, do you do tweeting and do you do...
Yeah, I don't count this work.
Lisa, before you feel too bad, I think people's incredulousness was because that 40 cents in a word seems like a lot for... I don't know if people actually agree, but it's about half of what you make for magazine writing, so it's like...
Oh, really? Okay, so years ago I worked as a journalist, and I seem to recall I made better than that, but I had no idea. I paid because I think writing, if it's good quality writing, it deserves to be paid. And I think, you know, there's a perception out there that blogs you can get for free or you can get for next to nothing because they're not worth much, right? And we sort of talked about that, and I think that that's wrong. I think, you know, the people that work for me, I mean, some of them work for a week on a story, and they're not doing it full time, but they're spending, and they're thoughtful, really, really well-researched stories, and I, you know, that kind of work deserves payment. And, you know, maybe I pay too much, maybe I don't pay enough, but, like, I think it seems to be the right balance because my bloggers seem to stick around, so.
My question was, do you know, any of you, do you know of any sort of business models that are emerging for independent bloggers who have maybe aggregated themselves together and put up a paywall or anything like that for basically for independent bloggers not sponsored by a corporation or by a magazine to make money blogging?
I don't know about any sort of collective, and I would very much caution against a paywall, unless you'll have a very leaky paywall, in which case you don't have a paywall. There are a few people who I know who don't make maybe a full living off blogging, but who do pretty well. And they're people who, it takes a long time to get there, is the number one thing. You'll do this for years before you get any money out of it. A lot of them run on donation models. What's her name? The Brain Pickings woman. She does very well. And she gets donations and she does some other things to make her money. And then, so yeah, there's a bunch of people who, if you do something that's good enough, some people will pay you for it, but it's very rare. And it's not like a path that you can expect to work. It sort of happens.
Does anybody here know Stephen Leahy? No, because he, I don't know how he does it, but I follow him, and he goes and covers climate change stories, and he goes around the world, and he's got his own, yeah. So,
he works for environmental newsletter.
He does. Okay, I thought he was kind of independent on his own.
Okay. As Colin, I do think it's much too early in the history of blogging to have independent bloggers able to make a living about that. In fact, in the larger blogosphere, we have one recent example, Andrew Sullivan, who's blogging about politics and society and economy, but is far, far beyond the popularity and the audience of any science bloggers I can think of. And it's only beginning. He tried to create an affair, a model, business model, a year ago now. We will have to wait at least another year to see if it works.
The path that you're looking at is probably one that a lot of freelancers take when they're starting, in that I go to the Science Online Conference, and they always have a thing about journalist freelancers. And the thing that they always caution you about when you're trying to break into freelancing, maybe you're working in communications, maybe you're fresh out of school, is that your first 2 years, you will lose a lot of money. And it takes a long time to get going. And so it sort of helps to have a part-time job or something, you know, the barista working on their acting career. It's the same sort of thing. Like, you have a job, but you leave yourself enough time to work on this thing that you think is very important to you and you think is going to get somewhere, but you want to have that safety net because you can't rely, if it's donations, you can't rely on it and that sort of thing. So it's just, so a lot of freelancers will have a part-time job. And the two colleagues that I have at Smithsonian use Smithsonian as their sort of baseline thing, and then they freelance off that. But they know that their rent's paid, right? So
I'm a university communicator, and I write a lot of feature stories for our website about research, and they're sort of packaged like news stories as a way to kind of resonate with journalists and do some media outreach and try to encourage people to write about our researchers. And I have flirted with the idea of writing a blog. So it was. Because just a lot of times I'm writing stories and I feel a little bit constrained in the sense that I'm not able to inject a little bit of my own thoughts and impressions in these stories. And it was interesting to hear Lisa talk about, you know, writing a blog that's technically under an institutional banner like the stem cell research. But then to hear Colin talk about, you know, building trust with your audience. And I guess, you know, I'm sure there would be some institutional angst about, first of all, about me writing the blog. And then I'd also worry about building an audience and building trust among people who might, you know, look at a blog like that from the university PR guy and not look at it without being somewhat skeptical about it. So I guess my question is, I mean, do you think that people like myself, because there's other university communicators here, do you think people like university communicators could comfortably write blogs that would sort of achieve some of the things that you talked about? I guess my question is for Colin. And feel free to be brutally honest.
I think the way that it can work is, because I'd be really hesitant, not to be like snarky or anything, but like when you see someone who's employed by something writing good stories about the thing that they're employed by, right? Like you, I would be sad if people did not look at that skeptically, sort of. But where one thing that a lot of universities use is a technique which could sort of be turned into a blog idea is, you know, when there's a breaking news thing, you say, you know, here's my experts list. Hey, journalists, here are the people who I have on hand to talk about this. Just talk to the person who is your expert and say, write a thing about this topic. Like, this is your area of expertise. You don't have to even talk about your work. You don't have to talk about the school. Just talk about, this is the thing. You know a lot about it. Help people understand this. And I think maybe you're doing the writing wouldn't be so much, but organizing and editing and working with those people, you can help them write it, you can help them put it together into a story that would be really interesting, but it has to be, you have to sort of maintain that independence, I think, if you want not that skepticality. But I'm sure there's a lot of opinions.
I can just add to that, because what you just described is when I first conceived of the blog that I had, that was kind of how I saw it. I could get, you know, there's lots of research papers are written. We have like 100 odd researchers within our network, and they're publishing stuff all the time. it didn't work. And the reason it didn't work is, for me, the main reason is that the researchers, asking them to write a blog piece, I mean, some of them were really interested, but I'd say that was probably out of 100, that was probably 5. And they don't have time to write, and they don't get credit for it. Yeah, so that, I mean, I still can do that on occasion. Like I said, there are about 5 that are interested in this sort of thing, but even just getting their time, and the, you know, the more, you know, well-known they become, the harder it is to grab their time. So, and that was, you know, when I realized very quickly that that wasn't going to work as a model, that's when I started looking towards the, you know, the PhDs and the postdocs, and because they're still very knowledgeable. They just don't have the, you know, they're not always at conferences. They're not always having to do all these appearances. And they were also, being younger, way more interested in blogging and online communications, which was another big plus. But as to, you know, whether you want to do it yourself, you know, I think that would be depend on your institution. Like I said, I'm really lucky where I am because, you know, I don't have to wave the corporate banner, and they understand why I insisted that we don't do it, because I wanted the blog to occupy a space that wasn't, you know, so narrow that, you know, people read it, oh yeah, it's another one of those stories about the Stem Cell Network talking about all their research. We don't want to, you know, they'll get to the second paragraph and they're like, forget it, right? But not all institutions are like that, and it's, you know, as soon as you get like the big PR engines running in some of those institutions, it becomes even more difficult. The only suggestion I would say is that, you know, if you have, you, I think you could probably campaign or talk to them about getting your own blog, but I would really try to keep your blog focused on, you know, either make it a news blog, maybe that's going to compete with your press releases and those other news stories, but maybe there's a way to kind of make it yours. And so an example is Matt Shipman, who's down at, he's a communicator, working pretty much the same position as you do. He's down in North Carolina.
NC State.
He's got that, but he also has a blog that he promotes. And he mostly writes about science communications, but sometimes he'll bring research in and he'll talk about the research that's going on, like, close to him. So there's...
I think it's affiliated with Nature.
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure where it started. I think it's with Nature now, but it's it may have started on the university website. That I'm not sure about, but he does work primarily as a communicator at an institution.
I have a question for Colin. Colin, if you're about a job at a wire service, you know, if you can crank out 12 stories in 15 hours.
We'll see.
But I'm just curious, like, how long are these stories? Like, I can't imagine doing that. And they look like great stories.
Well, they can vary. And, you know, I showed good examples, right? Some of them are less good. So, not everything hits this mark, right? Some of them, I try to never...
More than an hour.
Those ones probably took, like, an hour and a half. But so the trick is that, like, and so they can go from, you know, 200 to like 1,000 words, and then my editor gets mad at me because it's really long. But so there's a lot of things, like, if something has happened in history, you can find the big 8-page New York Times story and be like, quote, says the New York Times, right? So it's not a lot of digging so much as condensing. Sorry? Well, so you'll say, like, this thing happened today, says the New York Times, link to their story. And then you'll say, and this is some of the implications, link to some other story about things that are tied to it, and then here's some history, and you link back to the source on that. So what a lot of it is, sort of the version of the stories that a lot of, that we do sometimes is sort of like, here's this big thing that's happening. Here's what you need to know, and here are all the big stories where you can get all the information, but here's, like, the short version. So that's a lot of it sometimes. They can be short, they can be longer, and some of the original ones that I do, like if I find a study that I think is interesting, that'll be more, you read the study, you dig through it, you pull out quotes, you get other stuff. So those ones are the original ones, but they, like the really original ones, but they tend to take, you know, maybe 2 hours kind of thing.
I have a comment and a question. The comment's for Lisa. I'm not sure you've chosen the correct Star Trek captain. Picard is not known for engagement. He's known for saying, make it so.
Oh, that's cool. So who said engage?
And for Pascal,
No, wait a minute. I need to know who said engage.
Sorry?
I need to know.
No, what did you say? What happened? Communication. He's actually, he orders whatever it is. It wasn't his.
See, I knew he said wake it so, but didn't he also say engage? He'd also said engage? We're going to have to Google this. Somebody needs to Google this.
Pascal, in terms of the French blogs and the book that just come out, would we be able to look at them and see a different worldview expressed in these blogs from the, you know, you described the thousands of blogs in the English-speaking world? Would we, are they different?
Different from what?
Well, you were describing the thousands of blogs that exist in the, and bloggers.
Okay, different because of French-speaking perspective?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Is there a different, would we look at this and say, look, this is, it's not simply the same sentiment in French, but there's some difference to it.
I think you will find perspective from the bloggers from Quebec and another from the bloggers from France. The same way that if you're reading American and British newspaper, you will feel a different perspective. That's why we have national and local newspaper, because we want a perspective like our own. So yes, we feel that when we are reading the blogs that there are subjects and tendency, a way by which the people from France will choose their subjects or treat them, that we will not do it in Quebec. But yes, I think.
Give an example.
Oh boy. In France, they seems to have tendencies to make a lot more longer posts about where they want to cover all the spectrum of a subject. While our Quebec bloggers are more are nearer from the journalistic style, when you choose an angle, you choose part of the subject, or something linked to the news, recent news. I have no explanation. I cannot go further than that. But that's something that that was really tangible when we choose the blogs, the posts.
A question for Pascal. You mentioned just briefly on the way out how to pay for this, and universities was part of that, and perhaps funding agencies. I know CIHR has some science journalism money that they put out. In fact, I think Margaret had got some of that for a good series on Native people and diabetes and obesity and that sort of thing. If you were to make the case to the university, wherever the funding pot was, or the agency that gives money for such things, how would you sell that idea to them?
Well, one simple idea would be the next time you will buy, that goes for the universities, next time you will buy an ad in the newspaper, ask that this ad will be put in the science page. And the first time they will say to you, no, we don't have any science page. The second time, the people in the selling business will go up to the editor and say, well, we have something strange happening here. We have some strange people asking some strange things. The main reason why they don't have a science page in newspapers is because they don't have ads for that. And of course, they feel that the public will not read that, public will be afraid of science. But you arrive with a need. Why do they have a car section or an automobile section or a house section in every newspaper in North America? Because they have a lot of ads. So it doesn't take a lot of ads, because I'm not talking about creating 20-page sections each day, but only one page weekly, like we had 20 years ago. It doesn't take a lot of efforts.
And I just wanted to just close with some of what Pascal had said about a community of bloggers, and just to note that there is a group of Canadian bloggers who are pulling together a blog, an aggregator of all kinds of Canadian blogs. We talked about the fact there's lack of a science magazine in Canada, and yes, there is a paucity of Canadian-based blogs as well, but they are there, and I think it's supposed to launch this fall, but look for an aggregator that will give you an idea of all the blogs or a bunch of the blogs that are existing in Canada, and it'll be a good resource for not just information but perhaps job opportunities as well.
I have one question before we close, and that's, did we answer the question, is it worth it? What makes it worth it? Can you guys?
Just to summarize my own thing in 2 seconds, doing something where you have no publishing schedule, you don't have to wait for the next day's paper. It's more like the breaking news model, but where you can provide a different kind of story and for the context and history pieces that a lot of places are not doing, because it's not breaking news per se, right? You can do different kinds of stories through blogging than fit traditional models, and I think they're very valuable. So I think from whether it's worth it in like an ideological perspective, I think it is, because you can get information in front of people very, very quickly that is helpful, that does not necessarily fit within other models.
Just one sentence, talking about subjects that are very important to you and for which you don't find any channels to publish it.
I'm not sure if I can add anything to what has already been said, but I mean, my answer is yes, and then for me it's, because I only write occasionally, but for me it's being able to communicate in ways that, you know, aren't being done a lot of places, especially in a very specific area of science. That's probably it.
Thank you very much, everybody. It was great. A little hand to the side. I'm just going to take these a minute to tell you, and you probably know this, that the CSWA has, we give our main page of our website every Monday, a blog goes up. And I have a rotating list of guest bloggers, which I guess you end up blogging every 4 months, maybe, is that's how many we have. So if you want to get on that list, contact me. I'm easy to find, jude.isabella@gmail.com, or I think it's bloggerboss@sciencewriters.ca. I'm also bloggerboss. So, and just to give you a little instructions here, I just need something. Just contact me. I'll put you on the schedule. I need it by Sunday. I don't edit it. I read through it. I make sure the links work. I slap a photo up. If you don't give me one, I find one. If you don't give me the links, I choose the links, so who knows what you'll get. I like to be funny. So anyway, just contact me if you want to be on a regular schedule. We also encourage midweek blogging, and that's if you happen to have something you're really desperate to say, you don't want to be part of the regular roster. Again, contact bloggerboss@sciencewriters.ca, and I need tell me what you'd like to do. It's got to be science-based, obviously, and I need the copy by Wednesday, and I put it up Thursday morning. What we would like to do, I think eventually, Steve and I have talked about this, Colin and I have talked about this, how to morph this into something more like Signal, where we can maybe pay 40 cents a word, which, you know, some people wouldn't I sneeze at, right? Especially students. And Colin had some ideas about that. So, and if you want to talk to me about the blog, please do. Thanks very much for coming out.